Discovery is no longer a science vessel. It's a warship.
If we're going to win this thing,
we have one chance to get it right.
We received a distress signal.
I told you we'd be ready when you called, and we are. Go.
Open containment fence, not a good idea.
Collision is imminent.
Shields up.
I'm sorry.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, remaining unconvinced by my threat ganglia.
And we are here to tackle episode 4 of Star Trek Discovery, The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun, dun. Cam, how many times did you have to memorize the name of this episode title here?
I had to look at my paper when I said it just now.
Okay, can we just call it Butcher for the rest of this episode? Because I'm going to get messed up.
Butcher or Lamb's Cry.
Lamb's sure. Cry, okay.
Just, you know, it just, I was a little saddened that there was no Silence of the Lambs homage in this episode, because I'm like, going into it, how do you not somehow reference Hannibal Lecter?
Well, you got the Brian Fuller connection, right?
That's true, yeah.
Okay. So, Cam, what we're going to do with this kind of episode reviews, we're going to bounce off an earlier show that we did, what, maybe 6-7 months ago on our podcast. This
sure.
is, yeah, this is Early Departures, where we tackled characters like Jadzia Dax, Tasha Yar, Kes.
That was a very popular episode.
Yeah, it was main yeah. characters that had left the series early. And this is kind of a similar situation, kind of, sort of, not really, but I think they're going into this, we had a lot of high expectations for one Commander Landry.
I was a fan. Yeah.
Were you? Okay, we'll get into it, because we actually had an extended chitty chat with our last week's guest, Vicky Sue.
Yeah.
About
chitty chat?
Chitty chat, yeah. Okay. You know, like chitty chitty bang bang.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can see a lot. They have the two have a lot in common. Yeah.
But yeah, we talked about Landry, a different kind of character than you usually expect. You see, Landry's clearly Lorca's right hand woman.
Yeah.
So I figured there's going to be a lot more Landry story going on. And spoiler alert, dead, ripped to pieces, tossed in the most inhumane manner possible, ripped apart by like this giant microbe being.
Yeah.
You know, so. Early Departures, Cam. We're going to dive deep into the entire episode, but let's start with Commander Landry
and
meeting her maker a little bit sooner than we expected.
Tyler, when I think back so long ago at my first impression of Landry...
How have the last 7 days been going for you, Cameron?
I've just been floating on a cloud, you know? I've just been like... fallen fully in love with the Landry character.
Okay. Do you consider yourself a Fandry?
I do now. You know, it's funny. There was so much whining online from Star Trek fans, you know. Female captain. Well, we're back to a male captain.
Yeah.
You know, female security officer. Well, how'd that go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like...
Don't worry, all you white males who are really concerned about ensuring that your dominance is intact. I guess we're back to square one now, guys.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm intrigued by this because there's maybe some parallels to some other characters that we've seen in Star Trek. Cam,
yeah.
What jumps out to you if we're thinking about maybe a security officer aboard the title ship?
Female.
Who goes like way too soon.
Yeah, yeah, killed by a strange creature.
Yeah, I would say on Tasha Yar, perhaps?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay, but we don't know.
And similarly, like quick death. Where it's almost instantaneous.
Well, it was funny because they're like, okay, well, they're going to transport her to the sick bay.
Yeah.
And they'll save her life.
Sure.
Nope.
Dr. Culver is a miracle worker.
No, he's no bones, is he?
No, he is not.
Do you think Dr. Crusher could have saved Landry?
Well, she couldn't save Tasha Yar, who just had like a blotch on her cheek.
That's true. Rash. Death by rash.
Death by Armus rash. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I got you, Tasha.
Thankfully, Ripper the microbe, I think is a far more intriguing alien than Armus at this point.
What are you talking about?
Okay. Who has more, who has a higher emotional IQ at this point? Armus or Ripper?
Or a desk chair?
A desk chair.
Ripper. Ripper. Seems a little bit brighter.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Angie, because I was actually prepared to talk about how this is a character we are designed to hate. We're introduced to her. She's talking to the prisoners, like literally calling them animals, like we got to feed the animals.
Yeah.
She's very much pro Lorca's like military first sort of thought process here. This is not a character going into this episode I was prepared to enjoy at all. And I really had doubts that when we got our Landry centric episode later on in the season, that I would really come to care about this character.
Right.
Lo and behold, I had no idea she's going to get killed off. But Cam, what did you make of this? Because I think you're on the Fandry bandwagon.
Yeah, because what I liked about her was that she seemed like tough and like, you know, hard as nails when we met her last week so long ago in Context is for Kings. But I could see how you could take that character and have her kind of realize the error of her ways, like that maybe, you know, maybe Lorca is the problem and that she's got to, you know, because a lot of the characters, and I saw a lot of complaining after last week's episode, that all the characters on the ship are unlikable. They're all kind of negative. So I could see how maybe, like, they could change their way of thinking with the influence of Berman coming on. Or Burnham.
Rick Berman's back, people.
He's back on the franchise.
That's fan service, isn't it?
I would love if they named the character after Rick Berman.
You and I discussed about whether or not like Michael Burnham was like a shout out to Michael Piller and Rick Berman.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever had any sort of consensus.
We're going to say it is.
Yeah. I think we gave that a bit of a shrug, like, sure.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But no, like, you could see how Burnham could come in and maybe influence, like, because have her standing opposite Lorca and have people kind of realize maybe the error of their ways. And look, I think we can both agree Lorca's not here for the long haul. But apparently neither is Landry.
No.
But no, I really thought that Landry would be a character that we might see undergo some sort of change. Like, how many times have we seen a movie where a character seems somewhat irredeemable and, you know, has an about face at a certain point? Look at Jason Statham in the Fast and Furious franchise. He went from killing their friends to being their friend.
Yeah, he saves babies.
Literally,
he goes around and saves babies in these new movies. Yeah. He's getting his own spinoff.
Yeah.
Does it come down to the actor to a certain degree?
That Rika Sharma doesn't have the star power of Jason Statham?
Well, I would say this. Had you seen Rika Sharma in anything before?
I had not, no.
So I was very familiar with her. I was actually looking up her on
IMDb. Well, maybe I have. You know, it's tough to say. Maybe if I dug into her credits, I would be like, oh, there was that at one episode of CSI that I saw something.
Sure. But, you know, she's been a pretty prolific actress. Like, pretty much, like, any sci-fi related show filmed in Canada over the last, like, 10, 12 years.
Okay.
15 years going back to The Lone Gunman.
Oh, really? Okay, I did watch that. Was she on X-Files, do you think, ever?
No, but she was on The Lone Gunman. She's one episode
of that. I would have seen an episode of that.
Yeah, but I'd say I noticed on IMDb she was in 31 episodes of Battlestar Galactica. I didn't realize she was in that many, but like she was like a character. I was very familiar with her as an actress. I liked her on that show. She had a very clear arc on that show. So I was like, oh, okay, she's going to be on Discovery. I'm intrigued by what this actress is going to bring to the role. Yeah. And I was actually going into it a little disappointed because I just kind of thought it was a one-note character up until this point, though. But you had hopes in that, like,
well,
it's somebody who's going to be able to have an arc, right?
I will say, as we went further into this episode, I was like, I don't know that you can pull this character back. You know? It's like, I feel like we're getting a little ugly with this character now.
At the point where she's sedating Ripper and pulling out multiple weapons.
Yeah, I was like, boy, this is going to be tough to turn this one around.
The ship
is headed in one direction.
Yes.
I just didn't realize what direction it was headed.
Towards a sun. Much like the spore drive. Or as our friend, a good friend of the podcast, Scott Hardy, he likes calling it the Sporp drive.
So I think we'll be calling it that on the show Sporp now drive. In honor of Scott. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so early departure here. Is this as criminal as maybe the Tasha Yar or Jadzia Dax early departure, Cam?
Well, you know, it's funny because
I'm sorry, 6 seasons of Jadzia Dax, and
she
ends up getting killed on a harness.
I'm not considering Jadzia Dax. Jadzia Dax, of course, is a whole other level.
Okay.
I'm thinking more of the Tasha Yar comparison.
Sure.
And I'm thinking about it because we have a lot of fondness for Tasha Yar, but I wonder how much of that is just the time we've had with that character. You know, had you been watching it through season one from the start, would you have cared as much?
I think that they had built her up at least through the first 6-7 episodes of season one.
All those episodes are like really lousy, or they give her really crappy stuff to do.
But they had kind of planted the seeds for that character and said, yeah, oh, we have potential here. And honestly, she comes back in yesterday's Enterprise. That's right. Such a classic episode.
But at that point, you're going forward. You have to look at it. You have to remove the Sela and the yesterday's Enterprise stuff from the thinking about it, right?
I can't because...
Because maybe this character is going to come back in two seasons on Discovery. You know what I mean? Like, Tashiar was changed when they brought her back. Like, it heightened our feelings for that character looking back on season one and her death. Whereas if you've just seen it in consecutive order and you get to Skin of Evil, are you broken up or are you
so
like, eh?
You're taking it from the point of view, like, let's say Skin of Evil just aired. It's 1988 and we're debating our thoughts about Tasha Yar's early
demise. I'm
wearing
a Ninja
Turtles
t-shirt.
Yeah.
I'm like, cowabunga, man.
You got your short shorts on, your neon sunglasses, framed neon.
Yeah, spandex.
I get it. Oh, and it's like one of those like sweatshirts, like it's kind of a cut off, like right above the belly button.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And one of those hats where the brim flips up.
Yeah.
Do you remember those?
I get it.
Yeah.
And then you've got a headband on too,
mm-hmm.
but it's neon.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what's I'm wearing Keds.
What's on what's your Walkman right now?
I'm trying, Blind Melon? Was that in the 80s?
No,
that's the 90s, isn't it? Early 90s.
I think you're
what
probably...
I didn't listen to music in the 80s. Maybe Phil Collins. I'm listening to Phil Collins.
Phil Collins, okay. Yeah. I bet you had like Michael Jackson's Off the Wall.
Oh, my parents didn't listen to that at all.
No, my mom had
I didn't listen to it.
My mom had Off the Wall on cassette.
No, my parents listened to very lame music.
Okay.
We weren't listening to anything popular.
So, yeah, for anybody just tuning in, this is a Star Trek podcast, by the way. Yeah, okay. So, with the demise of Tasha Yar, I think it's just like, ugh, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
The difference with Landry's not in the main credits, though.
No.
And she hasn't, like, Ricky Sherman has not been on, like, the publicity campaign the other actors, even the minor actors, have been on, like Mary Chifo or Kenneth Mitchell.
Yeah.
Even Ensign Danby Connor, we saw him in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
That guy lasted 1.5 episodes.
Yeah.
So woe to the Fandries out there.
Yeah.
I feel for you. So why don't we jump into this episode as take it as a whole, Cam?
Yeah.
This is the first episode for me where I'm just like, I'm not so sure if this is working. It's
really?
Yeah.
This was my favorite episode so far.
To me, this is far and away my least favorite episode.
Interesting.
Okay, let's debate it because I'll explain to you why.
Okay.
Episodes 1-2, you're setting up the universe here.
Yes.
You're getting to know the big characters. You're getting to know Burnham and Saru, as well as Giorgio, it's very clear at this point with Michelle Yeoh's repeated special guest star nods that she's going to be a consistent presence throughout season one, at the very least.
Right.
Whether it's flashbacks, holograms, I don't know what other stuff could possibly happen. So I'm getting sucked into this universe, those first two episodes. Episode 3, we are establishing the Discovery crew. There's a lot of moments where you can breathe with the characters, get to know them, kind of figure out what's going on here. I love all the Burnham-Saru sort of matchups that we had going
too,
on in episode 3. This seems just more plot-driven, and a lot of it is kind of cliché sort of stuff with, like, that mining colony where when we actually see the miners or the families, and they're all screaming, and children...
Who saved us?
Who saved us? I'm just like, this seems like something out of, like, 1990s television in, like, a lame way, not in, like, the cool, nostalgic, next-gen sort of way that I'm okay with it.
Right.
This just seemed like a cheesy kind of CW sci-fi series. And this is the first time I started questioning kind of how they're tackling the execution of Star Trek Discovery. It seemed a little too, not premium cable, just more like really good network television to a certain degree. I don't know. Why is this your favorite episode so far, Cam?
Okay, well, look, I'm not going to argue with you about the miners being held captive. Like, you know, that sort of stuff is just like a cheap plot device to, you know, explain it, to give urgency to what Discovery needs to do, right?
And I'll just say this, though, but like premium television series, which I think this is striving to be, they don't rely on cheap plot devices.
Right.
And that's my concern.
I mean, I would be more offended by it if had this not happened in a billion other Star Trek episodes.
I know.
So I'm like, you know, to me, this episode feels like This feels, I think, more so than any other Discovery episode thus far. And there's only been three, and two of those count as one, really. This felt to me like it really had the spirit of Star Trek in it. Like, this to me felt through and through like a Star Trek story.
Okay.
You know, you have the story of the Ripper alien, which is feels so much like the episode Devil in the Dark to me, where it's, you know, about what is this creature? And, you know, it looks awful. So we must treat it as a, you know, this creature to torment to get weapons out of, because something that ugly and violent could only be ugly and violent.
Right.
And not only that, but it's about what will we as humans do for the good of war? Like, what will we sacrifice for war, and how will we treat others to win the war? Like, will we forsake our own humanity? And this was actually, to me, you know, through this sort of story, this felt like the first time I really got a handle on the character of Berman. I keep saying Berman. Burnham. the character of Burnham, where we're starting to see a little bit of her, like, emotions come out. You know, so a lot of the first three episodes were her being quite stoic, or, you know, wounded, or, you know, kind of defensive.
We get to see her being an expert.
Yes.
In something.
Yes.
And
we get to see vulnerability in that character, which okay. I really liked seeing.
But, if you're going to pick any one character that we focused on throughout this week, what character is this a centric episode of?
I mean,
I would not call this a Burnham-centric episode.
No, I don't think so.
I would call this a Voke-centric.
Definitely. Voke, and I love the Klingon stuff in this episode. Like, to me, it was like you had a great, like, kind of classic Star Trek story mashed up with these, you know, machinations of the Klingon drama. And I found that stuff really compelling. I love what they're doing with, like, Laurel and Voke. And then we got to see more of Call this week and kind of see more of how that dynamic works. I was really into this episode because, like, you had the world-building stuff with the Klingon stuff, and that is going to pay off throughout the season, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you had, like, the central story where I felt like I complained last week, where I felt like the standalone element of the episode was them going to that ship and facing off against Ripper, right? That's the kind of the one thing you can take from that episode that really does stand somewhat alone. Whereas, like, to me, the central story of this was kind of how this creature is being treated and something to take away from that. You know, kind of the moral of the episode.
I could say that's accurate.
Right. And I felt there was something for this one. Whereas the one in Context is for Kings, I was like, well, that was kind of disposable. Like, it didn't really do anything for me.
Well, it was fascinating rewatching that one because that whole sequence on the USS Glenn, I timed it. It was
like 8 minutes or something?
Eight, maybe even 7.5.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I know. I wrote about it for the blog.
Yeah. So it was very, very short.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I get where you're coming from. For me particularly, I was far more intrigued by what was going on with the Klingons than I was with anybody on the Discovery.
Right. I mean, this was definitely somewhat of a minor episode for, say, like the character Lorca.
Okay.
But I thought Stamets was great. We got more of Stamets, which I love too.
So far, Stamets is my favorite character.
Yeah, he's great.
But I thought Stamets was far more intriguing in the last episode than he was here. You know, we didn't get as much fun Stamets stuff, except for when he was in sickbay. You know, like, that was fun.
We got a little bit more, though, in the sense, like, Stamets is bones, man. He's the bones of this series.
Okay, so
it really solidified in this episode.
If we have to pick a bones from every series, there's of course Leonard McCoy, the original, right?
Yeah.
In Next Gen, who is the bones of that series? Is it Geordi?
No, it's Pulaski.
But she's not a main character though. That's the only problem.
I mean, the thing is, like, Geordi's too aloof.
But Geordi's the biggest grumpy, cranky guy on that show, right?
What about Worf?
Is Worf the bones?
He's probably the closest.
Can we do rock, scissors, paper? Because I think you make a good argument for Worf.
I think, like, Worf has more moments to kind of grumble about things that are going on the ship.
But I think, like, Geordi is just, like, this pervasive sort of, like, passive-aggressive sort of, like, curmudgeon-y presence. And it's so subtle that not as many people are aware of
it,
though.
But is, like, Bones passive-aggressive? Not really.
Okay. I can see an argument for either one. Yeah. Let's do quick rock, scissors, paper, best out of one, and we'll just decide, okay?
Two, three.
Okay,
I win with scissors.
You win with Worf. I honestly, most people pick scissors. I went with paper because I was purposely throwing it. I kind of like the Worf thing. Okay. So in DS9, is it Odo?
Worf?
I would say it's Odo.
It's probably Odo. Yeah.
And on we have Voyager. Do you think it's Seven or do you think it's Torres?
Or the Doctor.
as the Bones kind of, but the doctor,
he's pretty grumpy.
The doctor starts in season one, season two. I would totally give it to you, but by the end of it, he's like this jolly fella who loves to sing.
Yeah. Sorry, you said Seven and
Torres.
Yeah.
Who's the curmudgeon-y sort of like, ugh, guys?
You know what? I would say that Bones is very emotional, so I would say that's probably a Torres.
Okay. Enterprise. Do you think it's T'Pol? We got to go with T'Pol.
There's no one else.
Yeah.
There's just no other candidate, really.
Okay, so I would give it to Stamets so far.
Yeah.
Who knows? There's still one character listed in the main credits that we have yet to meet four episodes in. That's
right.
Lieutenant Ash Tyler.
That's got to be next week, right? Probably.
I would assume so.
Yeah.
Unless there's another big Michelle Yeoh cameo that we get to look forward to. I don't know.
I wouldn't rule it out.
I wouldn't rule it out. So, okay, so we've got the Bones set. But I'm digging Stamets. Okay, besides the sickbay stuff, what stood out to you with Stamets? Because I'm loving this character in that, like, he is the Bones character, but he seems a little bit different than what we typically expect from what's bumping around on the average starship. I can understand Bones, you know, being the curmudgeon-y doctor.
Yeah.
You know, the guy, but this is a micrologist. Is that what they're called? Micrologist?
I'm going to go with that and say yes.
Okay. But what do you dig about Stamets?
What I really loved was there's this scenes here with him, Lorca, and Saru, where the three of them are just bouncing off each other, debating, you know, the use of these, you know, whether the what's Scott's term again?
Sporp.
The sporp drive can be used. And I was like, this is clicking. Like, they are, like, these character dynamics are bouncing off each other so beautifully. And it felt effortless. You know, how often did we on some of the weaker TNG episodes or Voyager see character dynamics where you're watching, like, Chakotay, you know, bounce off of Tom Paris, who's bouncing off Janeway, and you're like, oh, my Lord, who wrote this? Right here we are in episode four with brand new characters, and I totally understood their dynamics. I understood each of their point of views, and it was just clicking.
I'll tell you the line that I think maybe best sums up what you're articulating here, though, is when Stamets says to Lorca, as I explained to you before.
Yes!
I'm like, oh, you know this dynamic between these
I'm
two
like,
characters.
I'm like, Tyler in space. So, so dead on.
I nod my head reluctantly, but I acknowledge that, I'm afraid. Okay.
But I also loved, you know, just seeing, like, Saru making a comment about, like, to Burnham about how, you know, you belong with Lorca.
Yeah.
So we're already seeing seeds of discontent with Saru. Like, to me, this is such a great episode for kind of continuing where we're going.
Did that seem earned to you? To me, that moment did not seem earned.
Really? You see, I don't know. It does to me, because you go to the previous episode where he has that whole talk with her about how she's dangerous and how, you know, as someone who has basically been a potential victim all his life, you know, he sees her as a risk that he can't deal with. I think he's looking at Lorca somewhat the same way, so it makes sense to me why he would feel that way towards her.
Stay with me. I'm thinking Saru is having more of a physiological reaction to her than a cognitive reaction, in that if he looked at all of her actions from, he thought about it critically, he could put himself in her place. But I think, as we saw with the threat ganglia, that this guy is kind of a prey species.
Does he have the ability to do that?
Or is he someone who's driven
by instinct?
Yeah. So that could be, and which I find is fascinating kind of characteristic for a guy like
this. And it makes sense because if, you know, in Starfleet, it's sometimes better to be cautious.
Yeah.
And so it explains to me why he's successful in his career, because his instincts are to be cautious and to be careful and to think things through in the moment. But does he maybe have the most self-awareness or the ability to really break down, you know, the psychological, you know, maps of other the characters around him? Maybe not.
I'll say this, you know, because I don't want to be unfair to the character of Saru, but they made it clear that Saru and Burnham, their disagreements, no matter how much affection they may have for one another, their disagreements go back to the Shenzhou as well. Our opening introduction to these characters was when Giorgio was saying, wow, my first officer and my science officer can actually agree on something.
Right.
I guess I better do it. You know,
These
characters have always disagreed about things, which I find fascinating. Like, so as close as they may be, they've served together for 7.5 years at this point. I don't think these are characters that have ever meant to be seen eye to eye with each other, right?
What I like is, and this is something we didn't see a lot of in the other series, but I like the idea of professionals who can work together and have different points of view, but aren't necessarily like best buddies. Like on TNG, everyone was best buddies.
Sure.
It seemed like, you know, when they're off hours, they're all hanging out together in 10 forward, except for maybe Picard, who's a little bit separate. But,
yeah,
you know, in Deep Space Nine, obviously everyone mostly got along too. But I like, you know, the idea that you can have two professionals who respect each other as professionals, but maybe aren't very great friends.
Who would be the best comparisons if we look at kind of like some pairs throughout all the other series? Would it be like a Spock McCoy thing?
I think Spock McCoy actually get along a lot better than they let on.
Yeah. There's definite affection there.
Yeah. What about maybe Tuvok
and Neelix?
And almost every other character than Janeway?
Yeah, I think you and I, we enjoyed watching Future Tense Parts 1 and 2.
Future's End.
Future's End Parts 1 and 2, and we had the Tuvok-Paris dynamic that I think we both wished that they had explored further.
Yeah.
That was good. The Tuvok and Neelix stuff never really worked for us, did it?
No.
So some other pairings that, you know, they don't see eye to eye all the time. T'Pol and Trip. To me, that always made me feel very uncomfortable because there's kind of this almost misogynistic sort of like thread going on throughout the Enterprise series.
Right. Yeah.
And it felt like all the good old boys kind of picking on T'Pol the whole time.
Well, it was like, you know, Enterprise was very much trying to evoke TOS, but they took some of the bad lessons.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't transplant those like 40 years ahead and have them work.
So, I don't know. Are Michael Burnham and Saru the contemporary equivalent of Neelix and Tuvok or Tom and Tuvok? What do you think? Because my problem is with Tom and Tuvok is we only got a two-part episode really, really devoted to their character dynamics. And it kills me that they didn't explore it further throughout the series. But maybe the best comparison is Neelix and Tuvok.
At least at this point.
At this point, yeah.
Maybe, you know, I mean, look, Saru and Burnham aren't in the best of states right now.
No.
So maybe, you know, further into the season or series, that'll be different. We're going to see an evolution with how these characters feel towards each other, I think. I can't imagine, like, four seasons of Discovery where they're just like, I don't like you.
I know. But I'm fascinated by this because if we do get seven seasons of Discovery, good. I get the sense that wherever we find the characters, like Saru and Burnham right now, their relationship has so much more evolution to go. And I really find them, I don't know, I could see this being another potential Kirk and Spock dynamic as
well. I look forward to seeing when they can use Saru more. Because, you know, with this episode and the last one to a certain degree too, like Saru, he gets it's a great scene. He has one, you know, in the turbo lift with Burnham in this episode. He has the scene, obviously, that I mentioned before. He's talking to Stamets and Lorca. And the previous episode, we had a scene of him talking to Burnham about how she's dangerous. Like, he's getting fantastic moments, but we're not seeing him kind of tied into the central story of the episode yet.
It's what do you make of Saru's place on this starship, which
he does not belong.
Well,
on this
Lorca
ship.
Made it very clear that this is not a science vessel. He tells us to Stamets, this is a warship.
Yeah,
Saru comes from the Kelpians that are not so much a warlike species.
Yeah,
I just wonder how Saru ends up as first officer aboard a ship like this. Does he seem out of place? Like, is this derived more from storytelling conceits more so than what Starfleet would probably do in a situation like this? Or do you think that the writers are going to reveal a very...
Or maybe they underestimated someone like Saru. They're like, he's a more complacent type. Put him with Lorca on this ship. You know, because he's going to follow orders and not cause a fuss. And maybe, you know, look, we saw that Burnham, you know, caused a mutiny against Georgia. Like, what if this season is sort of about the crew realizing that, you know, Lorca's mission, you know, this warship is not what they're there for, that's not what Starfleet is about, and turning sort of the tide of the ship.
Okay, so if there's another mutiny that would happen by the end of the season, Burnham, mutineer, she could probably be on the mutiny side. Yeah. You figure Saru as well?
I think so.
What about...
Maybe that's what unites the characters again.
Well, let's go through... Look, we don't know that
much. We know
much.
Nothing. This is not a spoiler.
Oh, no,
we know nothing. This is all just spitballing.
It's all speculation, because, Cam, you know me. I am super spoiler-averse. I try to avoid them like the plague, but I do love to speculate about
because
this.
I will say, like, I don't think Star Trek, at least I hope not, is a series that would, like... Okay, say, look, Lorca at this point, it's tough to redeem this character in episode 4. I don't think he's a character they have, like, the big explosive finale where he gets, like, gunned down with a phaser. I think it has to be more of a moral defeat. or something along those lines. Like, I think that character has to be defeated by realizing that he's, you know, in a, his mission is, you know, futile, or he's never going
to
succeed.
I've complained to you about this before, but I think a lot of times in like Hollywood, we see that, you know, you've got this horrible villain, and then by the end of this film or whatever, the justice, quote unquote justice, is that the villain dies at the end.
Right, yeah.
And like, that's not satisfying at all.
Depends how it is.
Sure, but it's
if it's
like,
spectacular, I'll let it go. But yeah,
I think everybody can kind of agree that Lorca is not necessarily the next Captain Picard.
No,
he's more of an Admiral Pressman than anything else.
Yes, definitely.
So I would be really annoyed if the character meets his end in, I don't know, like a phaser fight.
I don't even think that's appropriate for the character, so I don't think they would do that to him.
I would much rather, I don't know, maybe if he ends, I don't know, in like, I don't know.
Maybe a Klingon will eat him.
Well, no, what about this? What if there's parallels between him and Burnham? There's another Admiral Tribunal, and he's stripped of rank and given a life sentence, and he has to go to one of those Andorian mining colonies as well. Like, something like that, that would be far more fascinating.
Or he's revealed to be Garth of Izar, as we were joking about that on WhatsApp this week.
This is on Facebook.
Was it Facebook? Yeah.
So yeah, anyone who's not following us on Facebook, we actually like have a lot of great fans that will chime in and talk about their thoughts about what's going on here. So don't miss out. Follow us on Facebook as well. But I believe I'm just going to toot my own horn. What else am I good at, Cam? I don't know.
I believe it was actually Jason Kerr who referenced that, you know, made the reference to Garth of Izar.
Yeah, but I coined the term Gabe of Izar.
Yes.
In reference to one Captain Gabriel Lorca. So anyway, okay, let's go back to some potential mutineers on the ship. Okay. Landry, I guess she can't, you know, back up Lorca at this point.
Yeah.
Who else do we know from the show?
Tilly. I mean, Tilly's a character who seems very like nervous.
Do you think she's on the fence? What do you think?
She would be a character who'd be on the fence. She'd be like Saru, a character who might tip towards Burnham's side. Like, Burnham is essentially going to be the leader, right? And so it's, you know, because we saw before when Burnham tried to stage a mutiny, no one was with her.
Yeah.
What happens if everyone's with her or the majority's with her?
Okay, so we say maybe Saru and maybe Tilly's on Burnham's side.
They're definitely the two major characters at this point, right?
We can go to some ancillary characters.
Stamets would be with her, I think.
I don't know because, Stamets is not on Lorca's side. I'll say that.
Yeah.
So the enemy of my enemy is my friend? Okay. Let's go to some even more ancillary characters. Kayla Detmers.
Definitely with her.
No.
I don't know.
No, Detmers is the one who has the Seven of Nine kind of look now. She
was
like,
on the Shenzhou,
Yeah, so she's already been like kind of messed up by one Burnham. She's just like, I don't want to go with that again. She's with Lorca all the way, I'll say. Who else, Cam? There's Milton Richter. Is Milton Richter?
I don't. Dr. Culver is,
Culber.
Culver?
Is it Culber?
Culber, okay.
Yeah.
Played by Wilson Cruz. This is his first appearance, actually, the main doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a lot there, but
I dig his beard.
Yeah.
Like, it's very well, styled.
Definitely more of a kind of throwback to like the more terse kind of doctors.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going back to the beard.
Yeah.
Cam, who has a better beard? Riker or
No, Riker. Riker will always have the best beard.
Is it?
There's no competition.
There's no way I could ever.
No.
Okay. What other big characters have had beards on the show? Facial hair.
God. This is why people tune into this podcast.
I know. Spock goatee?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, mere Spock goatee.
Mere Spock, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Who else had beards, Cam? Oh, Geordi would occasionally have a beard, right?
Didn't Argyle have a beard?
Our favorite chief engineer from season one of Star Trek The Next Generation?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Scotty in the movies had a mustache.
That doesn't count.
No? Okay, not a beard.
Yeah. Bones had a beard, though, in the motion picture.
Oh, that's right. His disco suit beard. Yeah. Hard Time featuring Chief O'Brien. He had a beard in his memory from that prison sentence that 40-year prison sentence.
That's true, yeah.
Did Chakotay or Kim have a beard in Timeless, the 100th episode of Voyager?
I don't think so.
No?
Okay. No.
Cam, have we
I think
gone
we've
too
exhausted,
far afield?
The Star Trek beards.
Okay.
So
where do you think Dr. Culber would land on this mutiny, Cam?
It's almost too tough to say.
I know. It's kind of a silly question, but But it is intriguing to see the kind of the possibilities of where this lands, because we can already tell that
there's seeds of discontent on Discovery.
Well, this Discovery ship is kind of the antithesis to, I think, what the Gene Roddenberry vision was for Starfleet, and I think that is very much on purpose.
Maybe this whole season is about the fight for Roddenberry's ideals.
I'd like to think so.
It seems like it's going that way.
Well, let's talk about it, because when I hear about Discovery, and I'm just like, okay, I'm looking forward to exploring strange new worlds and seeking out new life and new civilizations.
Yeah.
We got to see a mining colony.
What do you got to complain about?
we got to see a microbe, giant microbe known as Ripper.
Sure.
You know, I'm hoping for a little bit more. Like,
I mean, we've seen a lot of Klingon society stuff, so that kind of counts.
My one complaint about the Klingon stuff.
Yeah.
And I, just knowing what my tastes are, I'm surprised I feel this way, but the nonstop, like, subtitles and the language, you know, the Klingon language that they're using, it's kind of, I find it a little grating at this point. What are your thoughts?
I have not had any issue with it whatsoever.
Okay.
I've been totally fine with it. It's a different take. We obviously haven't seen it before, but to me, it feels appropriate. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
It makes sense if there are scenes with human characters that maybe they can understand them because of the translator. But if we don't have that, I would prefer that. It's kind of like, if I'm watching a World War II movie, do I want to see the Germans speak in German with subtitles, or do I want to see them speak in German, accents in English? It's like, I'm willing to go with the more realistic.
I'll say
depiction.
Maybe it's more execution, because whatever reason, all the Klingon subtitled stuff that we saw in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, I think that works much better. And I don't want to be one of those fans that's complaining about the Klingon makeup or whatever, but like these giant dental like prosthetics that they're wearing, where it sounds like every single Klingon is kind of lisping.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, I can almost see their spit coming out of their mouths as they're doing these lines. I'm just kind of like, I don't know. I'll say this. I need to give a shout out. Kim, I don't know if you caught this, because like sometimes I was jotting down notes while we were watching the episode, and then I maybe missed it, like a subtitle or two.
Sure.
Did you notice the subtitle that they made reference to the Borg, or not reference to the Borg, but kind of gave the Borg a shout out with saying the Klingons must, I think Volk said this to Laurel, but it's like, we must resist assimilation.
Yes, yeah.
I did dig that part there. Can I bring up something that's really bugging me?
Uh-oh.
About the Klingons.
Okay.
Or at least the Volk Laurel storyline here.
Yes.
So it's been 6 months since Battle of the Binary Stars, right?
Yes.
And the ship's just been sitting there in Federation space.
Yeah.
Untouched.
Yeah.
Not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Doing nothing.
Yeah.
Running low on food.
Yeah.
Not scavenging as many parts as they can to get that dilithium processor.
Correct.
Does that bother you?
Does
it not seem stupid? Like, this is supposed to be Volk's, Volk is now Takuvma's chosen one.
Right.
And he's just been sitting out the entire war for the last 6 months because he can't get his... How come no Klingons have come out and tried to save the ship?
Do the Klingons want anything to do with him? Like, are they happy just to leave him behind?
They got a war going, right?
Yeah, like, what do they care about him? Like, he is an outcast. It was sort of an outcast ship. And Starfleet's like, we got better things to do than clean up a scrap field.
Okay, but that kind of bugs me as well, because I brought this up after the Battle of the Binary Stars. I'm just like, so they just abandoned the Shenzhou.
Yeah.
And it's just sitting there.
It's just, I mean, it's kind of like the ships after the Battle of Wolf 359. It's like, they're there.
You don't think Starfleet went and cleaned up Wolf 359?
Maybe later, but they did not at that point. If they're
within 6 months, I would say.
But how intense is this Klingon war? Like, they might be busy.
Okay, but
high on their priority list.
Would Starfleet not realize that there is a giant Klingon ship filled with an entire crew complement that's just sitting there in their own? This is Federation space. That was why the conflict started entirely. It's because it's in Federation space, and this fully crewed Klingon ships just sitting there, floating around?
Or is it just like it's harmless? It's like, what do they care about it? It's just like floating dead.
Why not, I don't know, send a ship over and shoot it then? I don't know. Well, no, but the fleet that went and engaged the Klingons in the Battle of the Binary Stars, what, they, it took them, what, like 12 hours to arrive or whatever? It wasn't that long. I don't think it's too far out of the way. The other thing that's worth noting here is, like, Kronos and Earth are really close together, are they not?
Well, fairly, yes. In terms of Star Trek, yes. Space,
well,
yeah.
I would say in Jonathan Archer's time, was it established at, in Broken Bow, I believe that they were either 3 days apart at Warp 5, which is the NX-01's top speed. They were either 3 days apart or 5 days apart.
Okay.
So this is 100 years later where warp speeds are even faster.
Right. Especially if you have a spork drive.
Spork drive. Yeah. Also recall in Star Trek Into Darkness, which takes place in the Kelvinverse, mind you, but they got to Kronos in a matter, I think, what, maybe 10 minutes?
Right.
Like, maybe?
It took Khan like a second.
Don't get me started on that stupid transporter that means, like, starship travel is...
Maybe he had a spork
drive. Yeah. should we discuss Khan's spork charter?
We're going to retcon Khan's spork.
Retcon?
Yeah, retcon it. Oh, yeah.
Don't give me... I don't want to go on a Star Trek Into Darkness discussion, but Kronos and Earth are incredibly close together.
Yes.
So it just seems weird. Maybe that's why this war is so intense within 6 months, is because of, like, the boundaries. And I brought this up, and I've been seeing a lot of fans post on Facebook, like, maps. Like, these are all just, like, fan maps and that sort of stuff. And the thing that people keep forgetting is that space is three-dimensional.
Yeah.
So people are drawing, like, maps that look like kind of the equivalent of, like, nautical maps, where, like, this is, like, Cardassian territory, this is Federation territory, and it's either on one side or the other. Whereas I picture that, you know, maybe Romulus is 90 degrees from, you know, let's say London.
Yeah.
Whereas Kronos could be perpendicular and then go up another 180 degrees. So it's not just, you know, side to side that space goes. It's up and down.
Right.
Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, and so that's why I can imagine Kronos being so close, but other Klingon territories being, like, way out of the way. Because, like, there's overlap. The stars would overlap Federation territory, and then other Federation planets would be over other Klingon planets. And then other Klingon planets would be on the sides of Federation territory. So... I think this is getting, like, very complicated, but I can understand why this would be a very intense sort of war going on. But
yes.
How urgent do you think this war is right now? How well have they developed kind of the urgency of this war?
That is one thing I think they need to work on a little more going forward. I mean, it's so tough because we're only two episodes dealing with this war. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a really strong sense yet as to, like, how big this war is raging. You know, we've seen that they're attacking, like, a mining colony.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, what are the other threats right now? You know, like, are they actively targeting Earth? Or, like, what is going on? Is there any sort of ticking clock on this war?
Sorry, Cam, I just had this realization.
Yes?
Okay, so the mining colony, right?
Yeah.
It was responsible for 40% of the dilithium?
Yes.
Is it in Mir-Mir? You know, the planet that they had transported on to, where there's, like, that kind of ion storm or lightning storm where that caused a transporter malfunction?
Yeah.
Was that not, like, a kind of peaceful, more primitive planet where they had a big dilithium sort of, like, stockpile or something?
I believe so.
I'm just wondering if this planet might play some sort of role, knowing how important dilithium is to this universe, whether this planet might, you know, play another role going forward,
like,
in the series.
Right, like, could be set up for something later down the road.
Yeah.
I mean, it would make sense.
I don't think this is anything related to the Mir universe, but it could just be a shout-out. I don't know, it's just all coming to me because you hear about the importance of dilithium. You know, the bigwigs at CBS, is that what they were really concerned about when they were giving the green light to the series? About, like, where they're getting all their dilithium from?
Oh, I would imagine so. Yeah. That was obviously something they pitched right in the room.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, let's dive into some of the other stuff with this episode. What did you think of where they've taken the Ripper creature?
Yeah, I'm good with it. Like, when we're introduced to what I described on the blog that we posted last week, as the not-so-friendly Okja.
Yeah.
I think it was an interesting sort of, well, actually, no, I didn't find him all that interesting in the introduction to this character in episode three.
No, yeah, yeah.
I was like, but I was intrigued by what Lorca wanted from it.
I think it's funny that it wasn't that interesting, but we both wrote about it for our blogs.
Yeah, yeah. But in this episode, I guess I'm kind of going with it. I just wonder if it's too much of a kind of, not cliched storytelling, but like we've gone down this path before.
Right.
You know, and I want, and I know Star Trek's about like understanding different life forms, but I just wonder if they can do this in another way. Don't you feel as if we've kind of been down this path before, Cam?
Well, I cited Devil in the Dark at the start of this episode, and of course the Horta, which, you know, is the iconic ugly alien that is misunderstood. I mean, Star Trek has done a lot of themes over again. I don't feel like this one has been done a million times. Like I think actually most of the time Star Trek sided against the ugly aliens. You know, we've discovered that at least a fair amount of time, right? When there's an ugly alien, often Star Trek says, like, no, it's evil.
Yeah.
And I like that they're not doing that here. Like, one of our common complaints, you know, on this podcast covering all these Deep Space Nine, Enterprise, Voyager, what have you, Next Gen episodes, they're not doing it here.
Well, yeah, the trope is the scarier or more frightening an alien looks, that means that they're evil.
And they set this one up big time
to
be terrifying, you know, slurping down a Klingon.
Okay, so you know what? This actually directly addresses one of the concerns that we've been complaining about the last few years over this podcast. So I guess, okay, I will give it some credit there.
Yeah. And I like that it's telling a very Star Trek-y story. You know, so many fans have been complaining that this isn't Star Trek. This isn't Star Trek.
Right.
This is pretty Star Trek.
Okay, but Cam, is this going to be an episode that is, when we get to the end of season one, is this going to be an episode that you think that's going to really stick out to fans? As like
it will
fan?
To me.
Okay.
But,
not as much memorable stuff going on as I would have hoped, you know?
Really? I don't know. Like, I felt this one really stood out. But
memorable. I don't know.
I really liked this episode a lot.
Okay.
But to me, like, that's going to be one of the curses of serialized TV, how many of the episodes stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are the episodes that people are going to remember are the ones where something major happens, like a huge character dies, or you know, a famous character shows up, or something like that. Like some sort of
Commander Landry died, Cam. Commander Landry.
Yeah, I'll remember it for that because I'm a Fandry. But you know, how many episodes will stand out to people? I think maybe Context is for Kings will stand out more because that's where the Ripper first shows up, for example. Yeah. You know what I mean? If it's a major part of the season, we don't know if it will be or not, but that's the episode they'll remember. You know, unfortunately, this isn't like, in some ways, unfortunately, in some ways not, but, you know, it's not like TNG or the other series where you have these standalones that are really going to stand out because that episode's story meant something to me. It's kind of like the story of this episode is a continuation of the previous episode. You know what I mean? Like, the story is just continuing.
And that was my concern about going into Star Trek with, like, serialized television. And I think some serialized television shows out there have found, like, the best balance.
Yeah.
It's still, I've cited this before. I think Lost found a really good balance between serialized and episodic TV. I think Mad Men did it to perfection.
Right.
I think Star Trek Discovery is still finding itself.
Yeah.
But this episode didn't boost my confidence that they have such a great grasp on, I think, some of the storytelling tropes that have become so pervasive in TV that I'm just like, just to me, like the whole mining colony, you know, like, who saved us? Like, to me, that's so cheesy.
Yeah.
That's not something you see in prestige television. You can see that this is a show that's striving to be prestige TV.
I mean, I'm willing to forgive like 20 seconds of kind of eye-rolling stuff.
I know.
It involves like a young girl using gymnastics against a raptor, then I'm just angry for like, you know, years on end.
I would be.
Yeah.
That movie literally came out 20 years ago, Cam.
1997. Yeah, that's true.
Wow. We're referencing.
And I'm still angry about it.
Yeah. He hasn't let it go.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about some of the founding members of the Federation, Cam?
Definitely.
We know the humans.
Yes.
We know the Vulcans.
Yes.
We've yet to meet Tellarites or Vulcans at this point. Or Tellarites or Andorians, right?
And we've heard both referenced multiple times.
Yeah. What do you make of this, Cam?
I want to see them.
Let me throw this question at you. We know there's some uproar about how the Klingons were designed or redesigned quite significantly.
Right.
What if we came back and had a revamped look of the Tellarites or the Andorians that were just as drastic as we saw with the Klingons?
Well, I mean,
would that be cause for complaints?
I everything's cause for complaints
among Star Trek fans.
Yeah, everything. Yeah,
you're right.
I mean, the Tellarites were changed a lot between original series and Enterprise. Like, just they had obviously far better makeup, techniques to work with, far more high scale quality that they could put into it.
But I was totally okay with those.
Yeah,
changes.
I thought they looked fantastic.
Yeah,
I mean, the Klingons have taken some getting used to, but I am getting used to them.
I still can't get over the bald heads. Like, I really...
That is
like,
a little strange.
And I'm not one of those fans that has been, like, adamant against the Klingon kind of reimagining. I'm just, like, I just don't know why they couldn't have put some hair on them.
Yeah.
Like, if you had done everything but keep them bald, then I would have been okay with it. Like,
right.
That it's even these, I don't know why they have four nostrils all of a sudden, but I would have been okay with that as long as they had like these manes of hair.
Right.
But other than that.
Did the Klingons of old eat their enemies?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Georgiou's fate, Cam.
That's awesome. I was just like, oh my God.
Well, I think there's maybe been some speculation that Georgiou, she may have been stabbed through the heart.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? One Captain Picard was stabbed through the heart, and he's still up and running.
Right.
So maybe there's speculation Georgiou's still...
This, to me, just felt like a total, like, she's dead, people. Get over it.
Yeah.
Like, this was like a definitive, like, the hammer came down.
For those who don't recall, they literally said, we ate her.
Now, here's the question.
We pulled skin off of her smooth, smooth skull. Those were their words, ate her.
Now, look, in a lot of, like, say, tribes, this would have been a practice you would see in warrior tribes, that they would eat their enemies, right? Hoping to gain strength. I'm guessing that's where they're taking that from. However, here's the question to you. Is this a Klingon thing, or is this a, you know, followers of T'Kuvma thing?
Well, we've never heard of this from any other Klingons
that
we've encountered before. So,
is this like a radical T'Kuvma thing?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, which goes back to T'Kuvma's all about like the kind of unmolested message of Kalis, the unforgettable, right?
Yeah.
So maybe this is like a old school primitive kind of Klingon thing.
Right.
You know, maybe that's what they were doing 5,000 years ago, but they don't do anymore.
Yeah.
For good reason, right?
Yeah, unless they were just hungry because there was no food on the ship.
Oh, no, that's a very good point. Yeah, they're running low on provisions.
Is this like alive?
They're lost in the Andes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, they're a soccer team? Who'd the Klingon soccer team?
Okay, we have Volk, Cole, and Laurel. Who's in goal? Who's defense and who's a forward?
I'm going to give Laurel, I think, the goalie.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, I think she seems quicker on her feet. She'd have quicker reflexes, I feel like. Volk doesn't...
I think he's on defense right now.
I want to talk in a second about these Klingons, the Volk and Laurel dynamic. But, Cole seems like a striker to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. Why don't we get into the
Volk's defense?
Exactly. Well, why don't we get into the Volk Laurel dynamic that you mentioned, Ken?
Yeah. What do you think of the dynamic between these two?
I'm loving it.
Do you think Laurel is pulling a long con? I feel like she's going to be working in the shadows.
What's her ultimate goal if she's pulling a long con?
I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Do you think she is upset at what Volk had inferred about she had served at T'Kuvma's side for years, and he passed her over and
chose
selected
Volk.
Yeah,
son of none. Yeah,
but then Laurel says, "Hey, look, I'm going to take you to these matriarchs from my mother's house, and they're going to teach you things you ain't never known before.
You're going to sacrifice everything."
Yeah, I fear very much we're going down cliched storytelling world, and it's going to turn out to be that episode of The Simpsons where Homer ate the hot chili pepper and Johnny Cash appeared as
God.
A coyote.
Like, it's going to be like a hallucinogenic sequence.
Yeah. I don't want to see this.
No, I'm not big on that. But I feel like this show might be like the rise of power for Laurel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because this is a character who's obviously working on the sidelines. He's been ignored by those in power. and maybe she's going to be the most dangerous of them all.
I'd be down for that.
I think, like,
I'm liking Laurel so far.
Like, Mary Chiafo has not had a lot to do. This was, I think, the most she's had to do, for sure.
Yes.
Since the series began. I feel like this character is here for a darn good reason. Well, and okay. I don't think it's just to play sidekick to Vogue.
Let's look at what she did in this episode that I think really bolsters what you're saying here. She was the one who convinced Vogue, you know what? Go to the Shenzhou. You need to use their dilithium processor.
Yes.
Like, you just get over it, buddy. We're building bridges here. And then also when she saw that the writing's on the wall, she was just like, you know what, Cole? Yeah, I'll eat your drumstick and I'll join your crew. Meanwhile, she transported over with her stolen marauder, I guess. Was it a marauder that she said, or a raider?
I think
a raider.
Yeah, I think it was raider.
I don't know. Anyways, she transported over and is like, hey, Vogue, don't worry. I saved your life. Now I'm going to take you to my... The matriarchs of the house. Oh, I'm forgetting the name of the house, but whatever.
Yeah.
She seems to have a certain sort of cunning and smarts to her that maybe Vogue is missing. Takuvma ended up getting shot in the head or shot in the chest.
Yeah.
Cole seems like a kind of, excuse my language, kids, but like a bit of a dick.
Yeah, well, so, he just like seems like he's driven by ego.
Yeah, so is Laurel probably the best Klingon character that we've been introduced to at this point?
She seems the smartest.
Yes.
And the savviest. I mean, does Vogue seem very bright to you?
He seems earnest, which I can appreciate.
Yeah, but he seems like someone who'd be fairly easy to manipulate.
Yes. But I like Vogue as a character.
Me
in
too.
That he is kind of the albino who's the outsider. He embraces that, as we saw with Takuvma. He's struggling right now, which I can appreciate.
Right.
You know, so I am digging Vogue a lot. You know, I think he's a far more interesting character than, say, Takuvma was. I think Takuvma's performance is fine, but as a character, I wasn't so interested in what some religious zealot has to think, because it's either black or white. There's not much gray to work with there, so I'm digging Vogue at this point.
Like, is Laurel building him up as like a figurehead where she can kind of pull the strings in the background?
I think that is, and well, she already implied that.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
when
for sure,
she was saying that, like,
I mean, on the grander scale, like, is that where she's going?
Well, she already said outright that I prefer being on the sidelines, like, because I can be your champion, I can be your warrior, and I believe her.
But she presented it to him in a more passive way. Like, I'll be your cheerleader while you're doing this. But, you know, I feel like there was two ways. Like, there's the way he reads it, and there's the way we read it.
Right.
Right?
Right. Cam, any final thoughts before we go to the Ortonville report?
No, I just, you know, I think it's going to be really, I really want to hear from those out there what you guys thought of this episode, because obviously we were split on it, like, in a big way, where I was, like, a big fan of this episode. I thought this was fantastic.
I thought, to me, it's the weakest of the four.
Right.
What I want to see going forward more is just more time to breathe with these characters.
Right.
I liked how, as lame as 10-4 it is as a hangout spot, you got to just hang out with the characters there and listen to, say, Troi talk about her favorite desserts.
Yeah.
Or Riker would give Will some tips on picking up the ladies. Like, it seemed like we haven't been given that those kinds of moments so far with this crew.
Yeah, and it's
it seems like a far more serious show.
It does, but I think part of the problem is that would come from the atmosphere created by Lorca on that ship. This does not strike me as a ship where people are hanging out having small talk.
So are we going to have to wait until season two?
Or, well, at some point. Yeah, I mean, to me is... I wonder how much of this show is like kind of a becoming Star Trek. It's about how this crew becomes sort of the Roddenberry ideal.
So very much like how episodes one and two are just a prologue to season one. Do you think maybe season one is going to be like a prologue to this hypothetical, I don't know, seven season show that runs?
Maybe it's about how the Klingon War creates a sense of optimism for this crew, you know, going forward. Like, again, it's all speculation, but we're trying to figure it out because it feels so just like shrouded in secrecy, this series.
I'll just say my big concern at this point, though, is it doesn't matter what series it is, whether it's Voyager or even Deep Space Nine, which I think people unfairly accuse it of being like very, very dark.
Yeah.
But there's a sense of fun going on in a lot of these shows.
Yeah.
Does Discovery seem like a fun show at this point?
Not yet. We haven't.
Yeah.
But I will say, like, I felt in this episode, the characters were really gelling
maybe for the first time. Because, look, we've only had two episodes of the Discovery crew. But to me, like, it felt like these characters were beginning to gel in a way that I believe them as people that work together.
Well, I think, you know this for me, Cam, personally, but...
You hate your coworkers.
To me, I think the most important thing that I ever get invested in, whether I'm watching shows or movies, is the characters.
Right, yeah.
I am very happy with how good a grasp that the writers have on these characters so early on.
Yeah, like compare this to almost to any other Star Trek series.
I know.
You know, they really have this nailed down.
They
right
really
out of the
do.
Game. Like, imagine if we were doing a comparison between episode 4 of Discovery versus episode 4 of all the other series.
Parallax.
Yeah. Like, I'm trying to remember the TOS one. I think this might be Enemy Within. It's like somewhere around there. You know what I mean? It's
A Man Alone.
It's not Charlie X. It's maybe. Yeah, I think it might be Enemy Within.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is not a strong period. So
unexpected.
The fact that we're talking about this episode, you know, at least I'm feeling like this optimistic on it.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
No, you know, if my biggest complaint is that I'm not so digging the story, but I'm digging the characters. I'd much rather come out of this feeling confident about where we are with the characters than anything else. So I'm satisfied where we are at in the series.
Right.
To me, this is not an episode that stood out to me. I think they're trying to go for the Star Trek feeling, but it didn't seem like a classic episode that we're going to be referencing like 10 years from now.
I can't wait, though, till we get to the end of this season to then determine how many of these episodes would stand out.
Yeah, no. Okay, so 4 episodes in,
yeah.
The two that stand out most to me are, it's probably going to be Context is for Kings.
Right.
Just because that's the introduction of the Discovery.
Yeah. So it's like a whole change of pace episode.
Yeah. And probably the Vulcan Hello, because that is the introduction of this universe. So those are the ones that stand out to me.
I find it almost impossible to separate Vulcan Hello from Battle at the Binary Stars.
Okay.
Like, to me, it's like one episode.
Are they?
Yeah. They really feel like one episode to me.
I understand that from you, but to me, I can't
remember where the separation point practically is between the two.
No, I think that's very easy, though. Yeah. It's as soon as the armadas, the respective
armadas when they
show
all
up.
Yeah. But it's just like, it's not like Best of Both Worlds to me, where there's a real like shift change between the two.
I'm not trying to crap on your point, but I'll say we are introduced in Battle of the Binary Stars to that flashback to Burnham when she's got the Vulcan dew and everything. So to me, that is kind of like the big kind of shift change, the big cliffhanger.
But in terms of, I mean, the episode itself, like Best of Both Worlds, it's like we go from this Riker story to like a plot driven, like we have to get, you know, Picard, you know, brought back. Like, it feels like two distinct episodes, whereas like to me the two premiere episodes to me blend together almost seamlessly.
I know what you're saying, because I think it's because the story is so propulsive.
Yeah.
Like the go from point A to point B. But to me, I will say this vehemently, I don't view those as one big episode. I view them as two distinct episodes.
Right.
So, okay, Cam, shall we go to the Ortonville report?
Yes, let the good ship Ortonville dock to give his thoughts on episode 5 of the Orville Priya. Now, Tyler, give us the gist. What's this episode about?
Mysterious and sexy woman shows up on the Orville, and the captain, played by Seth MacFarlane, is attracted to her, and she seems attracted to him.
Is she played by Christina Hendricks?
No,
from Firefly?
No, she's actually played by Charlize Theron.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's a reunion for A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, and guess what? His ex-wife / first officer seems to be a little jealous of this mysterious woman who has a whole lot of holes in her story. And when the first officer presents this to the captain, he says, "You're just jealous." And
progressive storytelling straight from Seth MacFarlane.
And doesn't matter what happens, no matter how suspicious this woman says, no one's listening to the first officer except for her female security chief.
Right.
Cam, does this not seem like every single cliched story in like 1980s, 1990s television that we've seen this a million times before? Guess what? By the end of the episode, spoiler alert for all those not following the Orville at this point, Ed Mercer, the captain, literally says, "And I've learned I always need to trust my first officer." He literally says that. I'm just like, good God. I'll say this. The Orville is not a show for me. And I don't want any Star Trek fans.
But who is it for? It's like fans of TNG to a certain degree.
But Cam, we have friends that are really big in the Orville. We have
it's like a war between our friends right now over the Orville.
And we have listeners of this podcast are really into the Orville.
Definitely.
All I'm saying, it's not a show for me. So yeah. I'm not judging you if you like it. It means it's a show for you, but it is just not where I find enjoyment in sort of storytelling. This seems, it's all very cliched storytelling.
Right.
This is something that seems like people would write 20 years ago, but it comes back to just being like really bad kind of Star Trek fan fiction to me. And Seth MacFarlane, fifth episode in a row where it's his sole writing credit attached to this.
Really?
One.
We're still in Seth MacFarlane episodes.
Yeah.
Huh?
Jonathan Frakes directed this one, by the way.
Oh, okay.
It was technically competent. And I just, to me, it's kind of, I would be embarrassed if I was Seth MacFarlane in that, like, he's writing, like, yeah, so these two hot ladies, one Adrian Pedlicki and one Charlize Theron, they're into me. So he's, like, at his keyboard typing all his, like, if I was Seth
MacFarlane.
Did it
give you the sense of discomfort I got watching the movie Chef? Where, like, Jon Favreau has, like, Sofia Vergara and Scarlett Johansson obsessing over him?
Yes.
I watched that and I was like, oh my God, embarrassing.
I would be embarrassed if that was Seth MacFarlane, but I think this is a dude who's been in Hollywood 20 years. He's a good-looking guy. He's a smart guy. He's a very successful guy. I think that's probably just his life.
Sure.
But the fact that he's just broadcasting, like, all these hot ladies, they're just into me and they can't resist. The problem with this episode also is that it was just, I don't know, Charlize Theron had like really bad intentions for this crew.
Right.
But we're supposed to convince that this was like a love affair meant for the ages.
Right.
And when it meets its end, we're supposed to care. And he tried, with all the musical cues, tried to make it really deep. And I'm just like, this is not working. This is just really bad, like, TV. It's not good television, but it's not television meant for me.
Right. I mean, I've seen Seth MacFarlane play a romantic lead before in How A Million Ways to Die in the West, of course.
Yeah.
He is not good at it. Like, it's that same thing that prevents him from being believable in scenes where he's supposed to be sincere. He always has that sort of comedian's, like, I'm only kidding kind of sense when he's delivering his dialogue. And so I never believe him as someone swept up in emotion.
Yeah.
And did it feel like that? Like, did it feel awkward or just, like, unconvincing? Because that's how I felt watching him, obviously, with Charlize Theron again in that movie.
Felt exactly like that.
Did it? Yeah.
The other issue that I have with this is just kind of, this is not a progressive series in any way.
Yeah.
Five episodes in, we have the first officer just constant remarks about how she cheated on her husband.
Right.
And it's like, I don't know why she would still be aboard this ship.
Have they ever given any sort of context as to maybe, like, why she was unhappy with him?
He worked a lot.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and again,
Has he had any reflection of his issues?
He admitted, yeah, I worked a lot. Okay. But he keeps throwing it in her face, yeah, you cheated on me.
Yeah,
it's just nonstop. I'm just like, to me, I'll say this, though, because I don't want people to dislike me just saying I'm unfairly badgering at the Orville. The one thing that I thought worked, though, is the characters were pulling practical jokes on each other.
Okay.
And I genuinely thought it was funny when we had Isaac the robot show up to his console, and he had no idea that the Mr. Potato Head face had been put on his head.
Right.
And then in retaliation, this is actually kind of funny, he went and amputated Scott Grimes's leg while he was asleep and didn't get why people were horrified by this. Like, and then he never told anybody where the leg was. And then there's just like this very dramatic scene taking place with Charlize Theron, and the leg fell like out of the ceiling. Like, that was funny. And then there's like another sequence where like they had to regenerate his leg, and he had like this like limp, like little baby leg hanging off of his limb.
Yeah.
To me, that sort of stuff, that's the comedy that works. The other comedy
that gives the show a distinct feel.
Yes, it does.
That it sounds like a lot of the time it doesn't have.
Like, there's moments, like, those are the moments where I totally understand why people are into the show.
Sure.
But just the overall, like, the A story, I'm just like, it's Seth MacFarlane trying too hard to do Star Trek fan fiction, and he's shooting for the moon, and he's getting a lot of air balls. Yeah, like, yeah. That's what I have to say.
I'm just curious, this far, what's the best episode of the five you watched? What's the one that you would say, like, that's what the show, like, the show was on the right path at that point?
No, I would say episode one.
Okay.
Because that was where I said, okay, there's enough potential here.
Yeah.
There's enough people behind the scenes in this series with Star Trek as well that I'm like, I'm intrigued what they can do nowadays. To me, episode one is still the high point, and I don't think Seth MacFarlane is learning at all from any mistakes that he's made so far. Okay. And that makes me very concerned. I'll keep watching until I find it absolutely unbearable.
Right.
Again, I don't want anybody to be offended by the fact that I don't particularly like the Orville, but yeah. It's just I'm intrigued by how it's so obviously a Star Trek knockoff, and there's so many people behind the scenes that were involved with both franchises. So that's why it's just a curiosity for me to see where they go with it.
Well, you never know. I mean, TNG had to get through its code of honor before it, you know,
yeah,
got some good stories.
Exactly. Cam, so. Maybe at the end of the Orville's run, we'll compile all the Ortonville reports into like one big podcast, and it'll be like 2 hours of me talking all about
it. It'll be an arc of you like building in enthusiasm. Like, it'll start in the low, like, hopelessness and just like building to pure ecstasy.
Yeah.
With their all good things like finale.
Sure.
Where you weep for the characters of past.
I can only hope.
Yeah. Okay, so before we close the show, we want to do some incoming transmissions. We had some comments and feedback from Context is for Kings last week's episode, so we thought it'd be good to get those out there and talk about them a bit. Why don't we start with, we had a YouTube video up called Would You Actually Want to Serve Under Captain Lorca? You can find that on YouTube, or you can find it on our Facebook page, of course, at facebook.com/subspacepod. Kimberly, who's a regular commenter, had this to say about...
I like Kimberly. She's always very insightful.
Definitely. Yeah. She said, I really liked episode 3. Some bizarre writing, like that Alice in Wonderland excerpt while Burnham is running away, but I love what we're getting with the characters. I can't wait to see how this story unfolds. Tyler, I think you're onto something with the Tribble as Klingon repellent. When I first saw it on the desk, it struck me as weirdly adorable side to this dark, kind of creepy character. But now I'm not so sure if this dude has any soft edges. I want a scene with him sitting at his desk, stroking it like a Bond villain, though.
I could totally picture that.
Now, she raises an interesting point. Does Captain Lorca have any soft edges?
No, I don't think so. Would you be... like, surprised to find out that Lorca's got, like, I don't know, a brood of, like, 9 children back at home, very much like the Von Trapps.
Daddy, when are you coming home?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I think this is a guy who's been through the ringer, and there's a reason why, you know, he's anti-Klingon or what have you. And that's why I proposed in the YouTube video in that the reason there's a Tribble there is because he's so... anti-Klingon, he's collecting whatever he knows would like bother the Klingons,
right? Yeah.
So these YouTube videos, they're kind of like their own thing, so people are missing out if you're not following us on YouTube.
Yeah,
as well.
We're not just repeating what's on the podcast.
Yeah,
because
that was a point that I brought up that was not on the actual podcast itself.
Right. Yeah. So another one, Chris Pearson says, quite a lot to unpack here. The characters were overall interesting, but don't always behave in a very proficient manner, perhaps. Lots of Black Ops stuff implied, possible Section 31 involvement, ? The Spore drive sounds really advanced, perhaps too advanced to have any lasting impact, barring a more out-and-out reboot path to the show. Now, for episode 3, I agree. This episode kind of shows that maybe the Sporp drive isn't long for this show.
Yeah, we did not touch upon the fact that we saw the saucer actually spinning around.
That was awesome.
What do you make of the fact that when Sporp drive engages, you literally see like the Discovery like turn like from side to side?
Yeah, I like that.
Did you? I thought it was so cheesy.
No, it was cool. It was just like, I've never seen a ship do that in Star Trek.
Okay.
So I was down for it.
I wasn't.
Okay.
Maybe that's why you like this episode way more than I did.
Yeah. But no, I think this episode does a lot to show the downfall of the Sporp drive right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they didn't drag this out because You know, one thing that I tend to get annoyed by with some prestige kind of dramas, or, you know, serialized stories, I should say, is when they drag something out a long ways. I think of, like, say, like the Marvel, like Netflix series, right? Where, you know, you're like, wow, they're really just dragging this out as long as they can. I like that already we're seeing the flaws of the system. It's not not like we're watching the Spore Drive being used for like 7 episodes. Going like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
what's the point?
I agree with you there. Would you give me this, though? Mm. Boardwalk Empire is really good at dragging things out, though.
I mean, to me, that's kind of a different series in that, like, it's so much about just kind of immersing yourself in the world in a way. Like, it's kind of like the rhythms of it. You know, we just saw Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
I look at them in a similar way. It's like, look, they ain't going anywhere quickly. It's more about kind of just being sucked into that world and just letting it kind of go with the flow. Whereas, like, Star Trek is a little more fast-paced. I don't, you know, it's kind of a different animal.
I'll just say, maybe our listeners might be interested, just our very brief thoughts on Blade Runner 2049. Yeah. No spoilers or anything like that.
No, yeah.
But, Cam, personally for me, I didn't really get much out of the first Blade Runner movie. I can appreciate it from an aesthetic standpoint, but it did nothing for me emotionally. I think it's a very visually stunning movie. I saw 2049. I really dug the narrative threads that were going on here. I thought it was far more engaging from a narrative standpoint. I thought Gosling was great in this one. Spoiler alert, Harrison Ford was great as well. But to me, it's the visuals again.
Yeah.
I have not seen a movie this year that I was just so sucked into what was going on visually, where I felt like I was actually living in this universe that they've created, as opposed to just looking at CG cartoony animation where I just roll my eyes.
Yeah.
This felt as if I was in the Blade Runner universe, and it sucked me in. And those 2 hours and 45 minutes... I felt it, but I was immersed the whole time. I liked it.
It's a well-paced, slow 2 hours and 45 minutes. Like, it does not feel like... I've watched... Like, I remember going to see The Thin Red Line, the Terrence Malick movie in theaters. And, like,
you saw that in theaters?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
And I'm like... Because I'd seen Saving Private Ryan a couple months earlier.
You're like, oh, this will be the same thing.
Yes. And I was like... My friends were so angry at me for dragging them to that. But, you know, like, and
guys, George Clooney, he's a headliner. George Clooney's going to be all over this.
I really like a lot of Terrence Malick stuff, but that was not one of them.
Right.
But, you know, Blade Runner 2049, yeah, like, I am also not a massive fan of the original Blade Runner. It's a movie that I actually appreciated way, way more the second time I watched it. And I got into it a lot more, and I just find it far more compelling. I have an issue, though, where it's like, it's kind of like the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, I love the visuals of it. I love watching it. Like, to me, it's not boring. And I don't mean this in any sort of negative way. It's just like a movie I have no emotional response to. I'm interested in just kind of basking in that world, but it doesn't move me in any way.
That one does a lot for me, a lot more for me than, say, Blade Runner does, though.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I would put them about equal.
I know what you're saying with, like, kind of the cold response emotionally.
Yeah.
But I'm far more sucked into the Space Odyssey world than I am the Blade Runner world.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I would maybe say I'm more sucked into the Blade Runner one.
Okay.
But 2049, I thought was, you know, if not equal to the original, I thought it was close. I've never been really that sucked into the storytelling of Blade Runner, either this one or that one, in terms of, like, the mystery plot.
Yeah.
I tend to find them a little bit rudimentary. Like, it's not, like, this great intrigue that I'm trying to figure out. But I thought, as you said, the money is all over the screen. It looks absolutely astonishing. You know, I mean, outside of, like, some of the, you know, really, really strong Christopher Nolan movies, you don't see movies that look this good.
I think the Nolan comparison is really, really apt, though. Yeah. It's where
they're like,
why don't more people do practical effects, Cam? I just don't understand.
No, you know, they do use CG. It's just used very well.
Is it something? Okay, I know I'm going to sound like that. Like, I talk about Canada, but it's like you got, like, Denis Villeneuve, why am I blanking on the director of District 9's name? Neil Blomkamp.
Yeah.
You got these Canadian directors, they're into, like, these immersive photorealistic sort of effects. Why aren't more people going with the whole Canadian technique of making it, like, photorealistic.
Well, Christopher Nolan's British. You could call it the British
technique. The Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth technique.
Yeah. I don't get it.
I don't know, because Quentin Tarantino does too. Like, he's made some beautiful looking movies as
well. But no, but he stays away from the CG.
He does, yes.
Where Neil Blomkamp does not. Yeah, but Neil Blomkamp uses CG to great effect, where I'm just like, oh, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, because when it looks this good, you know. You're just... And Blade Runner 2049 looks amazing. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
Gosling is not an actor that usually does it for me. I thought Gosling was great in this one.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I really was swept up by it. I was honestly, at points, more engaged with just scenes of flying around the city than following the mystery.
Okay, but the shots in... I don't want to spoil anything for you know. There's shots where they're flying through like this one particular city.
Yeah.
Towards the end, where I'm just like, wow.
Yeah.
I was just like, just in awe.
Yeah.
And I'm there with you. Like, yes. Yeah. Like, that to me was what's going to stand out to me. If I never see this movie for another 5 years, it's those images from like maybe I think the third act of the movie that I'm just never going to forget.
Right.
It's tattooed in my brain.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Ridley Scott, you know, even when his movies maybe fail, they are often like art direction porn. Yeah. And it was nice to see Denis Villeneuve kind of carry that torch, you know, and take it that extra step forward. You know, people are kind of expressing disappointment that the movie's not doing well at the box office. Yeah. Don't be surprised. It's not for everybody.
No.
It's a movie that is going to have, you know...
You mean it's like The Orville? Not for everyone?
It's going to have fans that love it forever.
Yeah.
But it's not for everyone. It's a lot of people are going to say it's boring. And that's it's just that type of movie. It's very polarizing. To me, I mean, it's... I think I still prefer War for the Planet of the Apes for this year, if we're going to talk about like big budget sci-fi movies.
Okay.
But I mean, Blade Runner is going to be on my top 10.
I'll just say this, because I was thinking about it, because you and I discussed it after we left Blade Runner, and I really liked War for the Planet of the Apes, but effects-wise, I felt like I've seen those apes effects before.
Yeah.
And I, you know what, if the entire apes movie was about them on that road trip,
yeah,
I'm totally down with that. But then you get to them in that prison camp, and that's like the rest of the movie, and it seemed to drag from there, you know. So that's why I would rank Apes below Blade Runner at this point.
Yeah, I guess the difference is me. I went back to see Apes again.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah, and I was just like sucked into it again. So
how long is Apes versus Blade Runner?
220 versus 245.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I would probably be more willing to sit down for another Apes viewing, just because it is a commitment to go see Blade Runner.
It is.
Although I don't know. I'm.
It looks so good, you want to see it again.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, I don't know how many screenings there will be of it when it leaves theaters. I don't know if it's something they're going to bring back.
Is this a movie that needs to be seen in theaters,
definitely,
though, Cam?
Definitely.
I would recommend that.
Okay.
Cam, let's
just get back.
We did digress from our social media.
We had one other comment, actually, from Trent Timoy, who said, Lorca is crazy, or in the words of Jason Isaacs describing his character, really messed up guy. But he's crazy about beating the Klingons using non-conventional means to accomplish that.
That's
definitely true. And it's something that we saw Sisko, you know, kind of delve into the darkness with In the Pale Moonlight.
But not like in, this. What was the episode with Edgerton when he poisoned the planets?
Is that for the uniform?
For the uniform, you are right.
Yeah, yeah. We've seen that sort of dark side of Sisko.
But that was like a couple seasons in.
But we've never seen a character completely submerged.
Yeah.
Like, Sisko still is, you know, like a guy who didn't need to be redeemed, really. Lorca is kind of past the point, maybe of no return, but maybe we see the redemption of Lorca. Like, who knows? Like, that's the thing I love about Discovery so far, is I have no idea where it's going.
I'm
going
to go back. It does have a Star Trek connection with Sinequa Martin Green, but with The Walking Dead, which is a show, again, it's not a show for me.
Yeah.
So, no offense if you watch it, but it's still a show that I watch, even though it's not a show for me.
Yeah.
But there is a character on there where I'm just like, maybe he seems like he's past the point of no return, but I have a sense that they want to rehabilitate this character to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that with Jason Isaacs. Can we speculate a little bit? I mean, do you imagine Jason Isaacs being a regular star beyond season one?
No.
Neither do I. I could see maybe recurring in season two.
Yeah.
but I don't see him in it for 7 years.
Definitely not. I don't think you have a character written like this for a long haul.
No.
Like, he's already insane. Like, he's looking like a lunatic.
He's collecting Gorn skeletons.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And I know some fans have theorized that, like, there's going to be a twist. Like, that Lorca is the one that's right all along and kind of the hero of maybe the show. Well, he's not the hero because it's going to be Burnham. But
Gabe of Izar.
But that he is, like, on the side of right. And I don't know that that's possible at this point, but we'll see.
We'll see.
Tyler, is there anything on the Facebook page worth giving a shout out to?
Yeah, you know, lots of good Facebook comments. This is from William Richardson. He says, Lorca is a badass, and he's ready to fight. He will be like no other captain we had seen. This is in reference to, we've been posting a lot lately on Facebook, just with, you write a blog every week, I write a blog every week. We also post these YouTube videos that are separate from the podcast. We're also getting comments from people commenting on the podcast, so you guys are missing out if you're not on Facebook. But this was in reference specifically to a post on our Facebook site. It says, meet Captain Lorca of the USS Discovery. He eats fortune cookies, prefers dark spaces, and might be a warmonger. But is he as intimidating as Captain Picard, who yells at children on his bridge? We debate the captains. This is in reference to Context is for Kings. And one of my favorite references was from our listener, Jason Kerr. He says, I think you just wrote his Tinder profile. And Cam, what was your response? Do you recall? Because that made me laugh really hard.
I wrote takes notes.
Yes. but we also got some other good response from that. We also have one. Jesse Oquindo says, this is great there because we did have voicemail from this episode. Yeah. He says, that sexy foreign correspondent from Oklahoma City, he is on point. This is in reference to Jesse's own voicemail message that he sent to us.
That's pretty amazing.
I can't really argue with you there, Jesse.
Yeah.
But a lot of great comments. You guys are missing out if you're not on Facebook as well.
So. Yeah, and as you mentioned, our blogs. Tyler, you know, why don't we just kind of hype, you know, what did you write about last week?
Yeah, okay, so what I'm doing, you and I, we're kind of on different tracks, so we're not, like, covering the same ground here. So I'm looking at, like, the 700-plus episodes of Star Trek that exists before Discovery and seeing what episodes I can compare it to. So I took Context is for Kings, and I compared it to DS9 fan favorite Empok Nor, because the narrative thread here is okay, you got, like, them go to Empok Nor and they're just reusing the DS9 sets. Just like, okay, well, you know, we can see parallels with them going to the USS Glenn on Context is for Kings and just reusing the USS Discovery sets. It's a very on the surface sort of comparison, but then I dive deep into, like, what's going on with the characters, how there's, like, a lot of parallels with regards to the conflict going on within the characters there. So look beyond the surface. It's a fun one. We got a lot of good response from the DS9 Facebook groups as well. So right. They like that. Cam, you're taking it a different track. Tell us what your blogs are generally diving into.
So yes, what I am doing is I'm using my lifetime of movie watching and reading about movies.
Porn?
Star Treks with three X's on the end.
Okay, wait. For listeners, though, you and I were at a Star Trek convention a couple years ago, and there was a Deanna Troi porno actress.
Yeah.
That, like, she was a pornography actress who would play
Deanna Troi
in all
porn,
the Star Trek porn parodies.
One of our friends recognized her.
Yeah.
But
she seems
not.
Like a genuine fan of the
show. She was a fan.
Show. Yeah, yeah. So, anyways, sorry to digress.
No, yeah. So what I'm doing is I'm looking at sort of films that may have informed or influenced episodes of Discovery or moments of Discovery. So, I wrote about Crimson Tide in week one. Last week, I found an, you know, I think when we saw Context is for Kings, we all saw the alien comparison between, you know, the Ripper and the Xenomorph. I mean, it was pretty on the nose. But digging a little deeper, I found some interesting, really kind of bombshell connections that tie the movie Alien and the universe of Star Trek together in a fascinating way.
I would recommend anybody just go dive into that, because there's stuff that I was reading there, Cam. I had no idea, and I was like, oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And these are, like, some fan-favorite episodes that you would never have actually kind of thought about the connections here, so it's really worth a read.
Yeah, it was like, I knew going in, like, okay, well, I'll compare kind of these three things, and then it was like, there was, like, bombshells along the way in kind of my research of going, like, oh my God. Like, you know, if you love Star Trek and you love Alien, you'll be interested to know how the two connect, because it's in a way you may not have ever realized before. And they're a lot closer than you might think. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you on our Facebook group. Go to facebook.com/subspacepod and join the discussion. We'll have, again, those blogs for this week coming up. And I've already got my movie in mind to talk about for this episode. And we'll, of course, have, you know, videos going up as well as the episode itself. So, Tyler, I guess next week we'll be tackling, we always do this next week on, but it's no longer relevant. Next week we'll be back with the next episode of Discovery.
Episode 5, what is it called? Choose Your Pain.
Choose Your Pain, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, who do you think is choosing their pain?
Well, I think it's maybe Volk.
I think it's Volk as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems about right.
I'm down with the Klingon narrative threads that we're getting here. I'm totally immersed. I just wish they had better dental sort of appendages than what we have here.
That's right. All. Well, maybe one day.
Is it dental?
Season 2, they'll get a dentist.
Okay.
Dental, they'll get like dental care.
Okay, I just picture them going into the dentist chair, much like Pennywise in It,
right,
and just like opening his mouth like that.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in very sad about Landry, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's Reporton, N as in needs dental care.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.